Hello and welcome to episode 337 of the Mark and Me podcast. As always, I'm your host Mark. Now joining me on today's episode is a legendary film director. I'm joined by Philip Noyce. You'll know him from classics like Dead Calm, also incredible films, some of my favourites like Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, The Bone Collector, and so much more. The guy is an absolute legend. He's film industry royalty, and it's an absolute honour to have him join me today on the Mark and Me podcast. We also on today's episode get to talk all about his brand new film, which is streaming right now on Amazon Prime, and I believe you should all go and check it out. It's called Fast Charlie and it's streaming now, and I can't wait to share this interview with you in just a couple of minutes' time. But in true typical Mark and Me fashion, on every intro, I always like to touch base and just talk about my previous episode briefly. On the last episode, I was joined by the guitarist from Thrice, Tepe. This interview blew up. It's my second most downloaded episode of this year so far. It's also my second most streamed video on YouTube. It's almost hit 2,000 streams in only 4 days' time. So a massive thank you to everyone that tuned in, has checked it out or listened to it. And a massive thanks to Tepe and Thrice for also sharing the episode on the socials. It's obviously a huge contribution to these numbers reaching so high. So a massive thanks to everyone involved. But today it's all about the director, Philip Noyce, and I can't wait to share it with you. So I think the best thing to do is to get straight to it. So here's me and Philip talking all things film. Philip, thanks for joining me today on the Mark and Me podcast.
Pleasure.
What I do with all guests is like to take it right back to the very start. I'm really interested when you were a kid, what was that first film you may have seen with your parents or family or someone gave you that made you fall in love with the idea of working in the film industry?
Well, that's two different events. The movies that I saw as a kid made me never think that I could work in the film industry, because there was no film industry in Australia to speak of. The Australian films we saw were made by English directors, like Robbery Under Arms or Smiley Gets a Gun. But most of the films we saw were made by Americans, and the movie theaters were owned by American and British interests. There was no Australian films. It wasn't until I was 18 years old that I went to a screening of what was advertised as underground movies to an 18-year-old in 1968. The word underground meant a place where you wanted to be.
Yeah, so intriguing.
Something risque, drug-fueled experience. So I turned up the next Sunday after I saw this poster on the wall. I saw 17 films made by film artists, not by a studio, not by a conveyor belt, not by Hollywood. And six of those films were made by Australians, short films made by Australians. And the most expensive of the 17 films cost about $100.
Wow.
I hung around after the screening in the foyer of the theater, and there were three guys. They called themselves film directors. They had beards. And they convinced me that anyone can make a movie. Well, I went home that night. I've hardly shaved ever since. And within 6 months, I made a movie as well, following, you know, their enthusiasm. And was about the sex fantasies of a teenager. And I was now, at 18 and a half, a movie director.
Amazing. In a country
that didn't have any movie directors, really, to speak of.
So what's that conversation like when you're saying to your family, mom, dad, I want to be a film director? Because were they
my father, who was a lawyer, said, you are crazy. So I said, Mom, maybe I am. So I went to law school for a year to follow in his footsteps. And the only subject that I enjoyed was criminal law because of the murders and, ghastly deeds committed by characters. I love that part of the law, but I hated contracts. I should have, of course, concentrated on contracts. It's the basis of everything that we do in life, as opposed to murder. But I didn't. I concentrated on the murders. I continued to make movies and screen those movies in that first year. And then I kept making more and more films, and my parents just gave up, you know. They said, okay, go for it, you know. Later, about 5 years later, my father got me a loan when I was in mid-20s. He said, you know, these little films you're making, these experimental movies, why don't you try making a movie with story and characters and stuff like the big movies? And I thought, oh, great, thanks, Dad. And so, you know, having at first repressed me, both of them then supported me. My mother became a makeup artist and worked on three films with me. And, you know, they ended up proud of their son who had disobeyed their direction, but had, you know, made a career out of making movies. The job that didn't exist when I started.
There's obviously a lot of shorts you did during the 70s, and then my first introduction to your work.
70s, 60s, 60s, starting in the 60s.
Yeah. And, sorry, I'm making you...
Yeah,
60s and 70s. And my first introduction to your work was Dead Calm in the 80s, and Sam Neill and Nicole Kidman together, the chemistry, but everything about that film still stands up today. I thought it was an absolutely incredible piece of work that you did. But was that the turning point for you? Was that the moment that you felt that you'd kind of really made a name for yourself? You'd really kind of got this cast? And
no, the turning point was the first big feature that I made in Australia called Newsfront.
Yeah.
About newsreel cameramen. It opened the London Film Festival in 1978. It was the first Australian film to come to the New York Film Festival, even though people would ask me, you speak English? You're coming from Australia? I mean, seriously, Americans at that time,
wow,
quite grasped the difference between Austria and Australia. But that was the turning point. That's when I decided that I wanted to have a career in movies. Dead Calm was the movie that brought me to this part of the world, to Hollywood. Because suddenly I was making a genre picture and, you know, a thriller. And it was quite bold, that story, you know, three people on two boats in the middle of the sea. It brought me here, and it brought Nicole Kidman as well. We both moved into the Chateau Marmont Hotel on Sunset Boulevard. We had rooms opposite each other as we fielded offers. Mine were to direct, hers were to act. And she came back one day from lunch and said, you're not going to guess what happened. I had lunch with Tom Cruise. He's asked me to star opposite him in his next movie.
Oh, my God.
Which... She, at the time, she was just 20 years old, you know, and she'd gone straight from Australia into the American A-list and has stayed there ever since. Although a story about her that I must tell you is she came to a screen test for Dead Calm, and she did three scenes. And afterwards, I went to the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and said to the guy that I was looking at, I said, you're going to do really well if you cast this girl in your movie. You're going to look like a genius.
That's incredible.
It was incredible because she didn't do better in the movie than she did at a screen test, but a screen test was sort of affirming for me because it proved to me that we had a great movie on our hands.
Yeah. You know,
because of the way she brought out the drama in each of the scenes that she tested for.
With the time we got, it's obviously pretty much impossible to cover your whole career, but
you can talk, we can talk on because you're the last one. You can
of
take
course, but you know, Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, some of the best action films. Harrison Ford, one of the best actors on the planet. William Dafoe. Again, looking back, was that a pinch me moment when you were on set of those films? Did it feel real because of the budget, the acting, the size and scale of what you're working on? Because it is such a huge film, both of them, and people still look back now, you know, they deserve all the awards under the sun.
Yeah, it was a pinch me moment. But they've all been pinch me moments.
I was going to say, you've got many.
Every film is a pinch me moment. I mean, because you see, we in Australia, as I said, didn't have a film industry.
No.
So it's all been a gift. It wasn't something you would assume. Okay, I'll be a director. No, you would never say that. So the movies that were small, the movies that didn't work, they were all pinch me moments. I remember on the first big film, Newsfront, first day of shooting, I'm being driven towards the set and I notice all these people and trucks and cars and and everything. And they're all just, I thought, what's going on? And then I thought, oh gosh, they're all here.
The crew.
Waiting, and the extras waiting for me to say action. You know, it was like, I was, you know, wondering what was going on in the middle of the city on that day. And it was me it was going on. So that was the pinch me moment, really. Being with Harrison Ford and so on, I mean, bigger pinch me moment was watching Bernardo Bertolucci in Beijing shooting The Last Emperor, you know, with 2,000
unbelievable
actors, with Vittorio Storaro moving huge lights, you know, that was a pinch me moment. A pinch me moment was meeting Federico Fellini and watching him add sound to one of his movies, recasting voices and rewriting the script as he goes. That was a pinch me moment. So there's been many. And that's why you can't help but want to keep doing it. You know, it's a drug, an absolutely exhilarating pinch me drug. You know, this is what you call work.
Is that what keeps you wanting to carry on, to have that hunger, because it doesn't feel like work?
It doesn't feel like work.
Amazing.
It feels like a privilege, you know. To be able to be paid and earn a living doing something that is so invigorating, so much fun working with creative people, which, you know, it is a drug in itself. You know, when you find people that you click with, when you combine a crew and you're all working together on what seems to be an insoluble problem, telling the story, getting it into the theater, you know, it's intoxicating.
Has there been any performances, obviously with the cast you've had, all the, you know, Denzel Washington, Rutger, Harrison Ford, all the people we've mentioned, has there been a moment that's taken your breath away behind the camera where you just were lost in that scene or that moment with that acting performance that just was on another level for you, that has stayed with you?
Yeah, I mean, Denzel, you know, is a master.
Yeah.
And he was playing a quadriplegic in The Bone Collector. There's a scene where he gets upset, loses his temper, which is partly brought on by his infirmity, as well as the case that he's trying to solve. And I remember, you know, feeling very privileged to be watching that performance, because he would work in threes. First take, he would try it out. He's trying to find himself. Second take, he'd completely nail it. And third take, he'd give you banking options. You know, the worst thing that can happen in life is that when you go to your bank, there's no money there. Well, Denzel would always give the director options. So when you're in the editing room later and you want a different, a variation on the performance or to press another point, I just go to always take three because that's where he'd store them away in a vault for me. And there was the alternative, you know, not too loud or softer or more anger or anger filled from something else. Usually it was take two, but if you're ever in need, there was always take three from Denzel. So he's an acting master, you know. And he's overcome the then prejudice by the studios against black actors. You know, there was a belief that if you're black, you know, you can't play to white audiences. It's been disproven wholeheartedly lately. But throughout Hollywood's history, you know, there's been that
Of
truism.
course.
There's a few others, like they had whites won't respond to blacks. Well, he proved them wrong in the submarine movie in particular. You know, what was it called? Quentin Tarantino wrote some of the script. Anyway, doesn't matter. The other truisms that have been disproved are women can't direct action, whereas what we've discovered is that they actually directed better than men because female action sequences are always emotionally based, not just based on collision and you know,
The physical side, yeah.
in the physical side. Crimson Tide, yes, that was the film that that just stunned me from Denzel's performance because, you know, there he was. He's the not the captain, but the first officer on that submarine,
Yeah.
and just a blistering performance that won over the audience. Anyway, sorry,
No,
what was your
it's all absolutely amazing, and I kind of want to, when you're this far into your career and you're still doing it and you still have that absolute desire and want to do it, is there still a list of actors you'd love to work with that you want to tick off your list?
Oh, you know, it's not about that,
No.
about the actors you want to work with. It's about the actors that are right for a part, for the part that task that you've got, you know.
Amazing answer.
And oh yeah, Denzel, that was a struggle, by the way,
Really?
to get them to accept him. Because you know the studio said nobody wants to see a black man playing a quadriplegic. Are you crazy? And
Wow.
who's this kid you want to cast? She's only been in one movie, Angelina. And I said, well, finally, I said, well, no, these are the two. I said, look, you must. Can you give me? There must be a figure that you think it's worthwhile having these two in the movie. And I'll tell you what I'll do. If we go over budget, over that figure, I'll pay for the overages. But if we come in under that figure, we split the underage. So they set an amount. And guess what? We came in 1,600,000 under that amount. But that wasn't the point.
No, you got what you
The
wanted on
point
the
was
screen.
we got the two actors that we wanted because they agreed on a price. They then sold the film straight away before we'd finished it. They sold half of it to Columbia. And in the belief that a black man and an ingenue would not sell internationally. And guess what? The film made more money internationally than it did in America. Anyway, so
You were like,
no.
told you
So
so.
nobody knows anything in this business is the moral of the story.
And everyone's placing bets and being quite successful if you know what you're doing.
Well, yeah, but sometimes you place those bets just because you've
You're
got to
literally,
keep going forward.
of course, you're promoting Fast Charlie right now, which is just about to go on to Amazon Prime, and again, action. You're getting to work with Pierce Brosnan, James Caan, unbelievable actor. You do have an amazing career that just doesn't seem to slow down. What was it like doing Fast Charlie and having this stellar
Oh,
cast and just being
yeah.
back on?
two idols of mine, starting with James Caan. That was quite an experience because throughout the shoot, I thought that I might be making a documentary because Jimmy would come to the set and he'd be completely disoriented and sort of seemed as though he was the guy with dementia, not the character. And then on the day we finished filming, I said, cut. And then a whole other Jimmy Caan stood up. He was energetic, he was on point. He was laughing. He wasn't sorry for himself. He was completely there. So what I experienced was a total conversion of his character to the character that he was playing on the screen. So that was really fascinating to experience. And Pierce, he's been there, seen that, done that. Just such a pleasure to work with that guy. It was Michael Caine who convinced me, and I think this is something that English actors understand more than American actors, that as an actor, it's your job to connect with the audience, but it's also part of your mission has to be to embolden your director. Michael did that for me on The Quiet American, just made me feel like I was Superman every day. And Pierce did it also on this movie, which had its own ups and downs and struggles and loss of money and changes and everything. But Pierce was just, every day I'd arrive at set and he'd look at me and make me think that I was a genius.
We
He would
need more
empower.
people like that in the world.
You do, but it's something that the Brits learn somewhere in your film industry or in your temperament, national temperament. Don't complain, just get on with it. Make everyone else feel strong.
Do you ever think you'll want to put your feet up and put the camera down, or are you just going to keep on going?
Oh no, because I won't need to even when they take my license away, which I'll do. But then I've got this,
For the listeners, he's got an
which is
iPhone with him.
4K, 4K. This I can write, I can photograph, I can edit, and I can monetize through a whole host of outlets. I mean, those two young Australians who made that horror film, what was it called? The Raka Raka brothers. They had a YouTube channel for years, which has been very successful. Anyway, this is all you need now to be successful as a movie maker. So even if I'm lying in bed in the old people's home, I can still pump it out, and get all the nurses and patients to be in
Extras.
my own little drama. Talk to Me is the name of the movie.
Yes, and that was very successful.
Very successful. Those two guys grew up with their own YouTube channel called Raka Raka, which is worth looking at. It's a wonder they're alive, some of the things they did on YouTube, but they made a living for years, out of their iPhones.
I suppose I'd love to know, because I have a lot of young up and coming filmmakers that listen to this podcast, or people that want to be in the industry as a director. I know it's hard to sum up with so many words, but what advice do you give to anyone at this present day to try and get their work seen or to stand above the rest? Because it is so hard, isn't it, to get into?
I would enter the Smartphone Film Festival, SF3, I think it's called, Smartphone Film Festival. It's held out of Australia. It has huge prize money because they can make their movie. You've got to make your movie on a smartphone or a tablet, and you've got to edit it. It's got to be entirely on a smartphone. Wonderful people have emerged out of that particular festival, and that is a way forward. It's a way forward for someone living in the slums in Nairobi. It's a way forward for someone living in India, way out, in poverty. That's what I would turn to. Go to the smart, look it up, Smartphone Film Festival, Australia. It's usually won not by an Australian, so there's not a home team jury. You'll see remarkable pieces of cinema. You know why? Because the TikTok generation have learned to use a camera in completely novel ways, you know? I mean, you can go into ears, eyes, mouths, and bodily openings. With your camera, you can do anything. And the way that they move the camera is the way that they've learned, to communicate with each other. Those movies are the movies of tomorrow. And those film directors that I've seen in that festival, are the greats who are up and coming.
And what's next for you? Obviously, now Fast Charlie's out there, the world's ready to see it. Is there already a script or a project you're working on? Or are you just having a little bit of a breather or?
There is no breather in this business.
You're never going to take a day off.
There's no breather. I'm working on a film about Cowboy Bob. Look up Cowboy Bob. Cowboy Bob is a famous bank robber
I'm literally writing this
in
down now.
Dallas.
Cowboy Bob.
Cowboy Bob, Dallas, Texas, in the 1990s. Cowboy Bob robbed a whole lot of banks. But Cowboy Bob, when they caught him, turned out to be a woman.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's a story that I've been working on for a few years. I hope to shoot that later this year. I'm also working on a film with Pierce again called Youth, which is set about 20 years in the future. And it's about a couple in their 60s who take advantage of technology to change their cell structure and return them to youth.
Oh, nice.
Except
Oh, there's a twist.
it works for the wife, but not for the husband.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The wife's 25 and now Pierce is still 65. That's a problem in any relationship.
My God. I'm very excited by what you've got coming up. I'm really excited for people to actually now see Fast Charlie, and it's unbelievable that you've still got the passion and desire and love and want you've had for since we've established the 60s, which just blows my mind.
68. Listen, I'm really lucky. I've never had any other job. I've never
That's
had
not many
any other
people can say
job.
that. I interview a lot of directors, and there's always someone that's had to do other
I
things or.
dug sewage ditches for 6 weeks with a jackpick, with a pneumatic drill. Got the money, sold parts to my friends, and made my first movie. And I've been. Somebody asked my son when he was 10, what should dad do for a living? He said, well, he yells action and cut. I've been doing that all that time since 1968.
I've got one final question. I've done 332 episodes of this podcast now. I've had Anthony Hopkins, Mads Mikkelsen, Aubrey Plaza, everybody on here, but I ask the same final question. And what I wanted to know off you today, Philip, is as the episode is all edited and ready for the world to listen to, you get to choose a song that you love. It can be by any artist, any band, but it's a final song that plays, and it's maybe a piece of music that means something to you personally. And I just wondered, putting you on the spot, what was that song that came to you when I asked the question?
That's easy. It's Ryuichi Sakamoto's soundtrack for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Incredible. And no one has chosen that, which is always good. I don't like duplicates. But what was it that put that before anything else?
It was the fact that I came out of the cinema when I saw that movie. I went to buy the CD and I just listened to it and listened to it over and over and over and over again. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
Amazing.
You know, it just inhabited my mind, my body for months. You know, it was just that kind of tune. Yeah, a genius composer, that guy is. You know, it was the same as I felt when I watched Apocalypse Now. I went to the 11 o'clock, the 2 o'clock, the 5 o'clock, and the 8 o'clock session.
Wow. I think I've done three viewings in one day, but that's it. I'm getting too old. My back can't do it anymore, and I just need to listen to me at 42 moaning, but it's true. I need to go and have a
42 is youth.
I know, I got no excuse, but it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you today, and genuinely I'm a huge fan of your work. You've made so many incredible films, and it's an honor to have you on. So thank you for your time, and I do hope that in the future our
Okay, thank you. Great, great conversation. Yeah.
I do hope our paths can cross again in the future.
I hope so too.
So there it is. There's my interview with me and Philip Noyce. What an absolute legend. A guy that's been there and seen it all for many decades, has had some absolutely huge success in the industry, has so many great stories to share, and it really was a true honour to have you join me today on the Mark and Me podcast. I hope everyone at home has enjoyed this interview as much as me. If you have, as always, please share it. It means a lot if you can hit the retweet button, the share button on Facebook, or even like it on Instagram or put it as part of your stories. It's the way that this episode gets seen by many more people. I don't have budget to go and pay for these marketing things or get the algorithm stronger. I rely on the fans and you guys at home that listen to share these episodes. And also, I do have a Patreon account. People don't realize, but it costs money to host these podcasts on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And to do this, I need the support from you guys at home. In return for your support on Patreon, I do give back. I make sure you get a welcome pack with stickers and badges. You also get an exclusive episode just for you guys at home to say thank you that's not available to the general public. And you get so much more. And I'm going to make sure that the guys on Patreon are going to feel really valued and bring you even more stuff over the next few months. But if you want to find out more about my Patreon, just jump on markandme.com and there's a little link there you can click. I also have a Ko-fi or coffee page or whatever you call it, if you just want to give me a little tip. Because as always, all the money that comes in will go straight back into the podcast. And this allows me to go out there and record more interviews for you guys at home. Just before I go, I always like to give a shout out to the sponsor of the podcast, Richer Sounds. If you're in the market for a home cinema surround sound system, a TV, a Blu-ray player, headphones, or anything within audio and visual, go on richersounds.com or drop into any of your local stores. Right. I'm going to be back in only 2 days' time with another brand new episode, and it's a huge one, and a guest that's returning for Mark and Me for their fourth time. So, until then, look after yourself, take care, and I'll speak to you all very soon.